So there are multiple things that follow each other. For instance, every good water skier I have ever met has crashed hundreds of times. Every good singer has missed notes hundreds of times. Every good chess player has inadvertently lost pieces on the board hundreds of times. Every good golfer has hit balls into the woods or the trees or hardly gotten it off the ground hundreds of times. But friends, just because you crash skiing hundreds of times, just because you've lost hundreds of pieces, just because you've missed hundreds of notes, just because you've hit hundreds of bad shots does not make you a good water skier, chess player, singer, or golfer. There are things that must come first, but just because they come does not mean the result follows. What we have in this passage, and I'm going to jump forward and give you sort of the main point before we start, but what we have is we have people who understand Jesus and think they believe, but they don't. But unless you understand Jesus, you cannot believe in him. But just because you understand him does not mean you believe in him. John 16 is where we're at. We're going to begin in verse 25. This is Jesus speaking. And he says, I have said these things to you in figures of speech. The hour is coming when I will no longer speak to you in figures of speech, but I will tell you plainly about the Father. In that day you will ask in my name. And I do not say that I will ask the Father on your behalf. For the Father himself loves you because you have loved me and have believed that I came from God. I came from the Father and have come into the world, and now I'm leaving the world and going to the Father. The disciple says, oh, now you are speaking plainly and not using figurative speech. Now we understand that you know all things and do not need anyone to question you. This is why we believe you came from God. Jesus answered them, do you now believe? Behold, the hour is coming. Indeed, it has come when you will be scattered, each to his own home, and you will leave me alone. Yet I am not alone, for the Father is with me. I have said these things to you, that in me you may have peace. In the world you will have tribulation, but take heart. I have overcome the world. These people understood Jesus. And depending on what kind of emphasis you want to put on a certain question Jesus asks will determine whether or not you think Jesus thinks they believe. Emphasis can make all the difference in the world. I was sitting in a seminary class one time, and a student, I think he was from Ethiopia, but I'm not entirely sure, somewhere in Africa, he asked a question of the professor. And the professor looked at him with a blank stare because he had no idea what the student had asked. So he said, could you ask it again? He asked it again. And the professor looked at him blankly because he had no idea what the student said. So finally he asked him to say it again. And finally the light went on in the professor's mind and he said, oh, you put the emphasis on the wrong syllable. And it sounded totally different. By making a different emphasis on the word. So we have to ask ourselves, what emphasis does Jesus have on this question that he asks? The question that he asks is, do you now believe? Or is the question that he asks, do you now believe? Those are very different questions. Because one presumes that it took you this long to believe, And the other, I don't think you really believe. They definitely understand. But the question is, do they believe? Well, let's go back to the beginning of the passage. I have said these things to you in figures of speech. He says that so many times in this last day of his life, because keep in mind, all of what's going on here is his last day on earth with his disciples before he is crucified, before he is resurrected, before he spends a few short weeks again with them, before he ascends into heaven. And he has said in chapter 15, verse 17, I have said these things. In chapter 16, verse 1, I have said all these things. In verse 4, he says, I have said these things. In verse 25, I have said these things. In verse 33, I have said these things. What things? It's twofold, really. There's the immediate context, and then there's the larger context. The immediate context is what has immediately come prior to this. The larger context is most likely the 3 years prior to him stating this on the last day of his life on earth, referring to all the things that he has said. I've said these things to you. I have said all of what I've said to you in figures of speech. But the hour is coming when I will no longer speak to you in figures of speech, but I will tell you plainly what. Because if we understand what he's going to tell them plainly, it would make sense that that's what he's been telling them figuratively for 3 years. What is he going to tell them? He is going to tell them how to live a good life. He is going to tell them, right, how to live a moral life. He's going to tell them how to be good citizens. He's going to tell them how to be good church members. He's going to tell them what? None of those things. That hasn't been at all what he's been telling them. Look at it. The answer is right here. In that day, I will tell you plainly about the Father. I will no longer use figures of speech, but I will tell you plainly about the Father, making it pretty obvious that what he's been telling them for 3 years is the Father. He has not been telling them how to be good people. He's not been telling them how to be good disciples. He's not been telling them anything but the Father. Because as they understand the Father, all of those other things will happen. But so quickly we say, but it's a longer process to make it go that way, so let's speed it up by jumping that middle section and instead telling them about how to be good people, how to be good Christians, how to be good citizens, how to be a good husband, how to be a good wife, instead of fundamentally saying, no, let's step back and let's talk about that which is most important. And as we talk about that which is most important, the rest will follow. Every preacher has made that error at least a dozen times or 100. That we allow ourselves to get ahead of where we really should be. So let's step back and let's make a promise to each other that we're going to step back. Now, I'm not just going to reveal to you the Father, because the Son has also revealed himself. Our goal as a body of people must be to see God. And I don't just mean the Father. But to see the Father and to see the Son, I don't just mean to see the Father and to see the Son, but to see the Spirit. And if we're not looking for that, what are we doing here? There's not really a point. Because you don't have to show up early on a Sunday morning to find out how to live a good moral life. There are thousands of books for you to read on that. There are thousands of other things that you can do, but we are here to together see the Son to together see the Father. To together see the Spirit. And as we see this God who is bigger than we can possibly imagine, as we see this Son who is more amazing than we could dare dream, as we see this Spirit who is far more powerful than we ever give him credit, then, friends, we're changed. But we're not changed because changing is fun. We're not changed because doing something better is better. We're changed because we see God. We're changed because as we know him, we can't help but be changed. That's what we're here for. That's what Jesus came for. And he has told them figuratively, using figures of speech, using parables even. And I couldn't help but be drawn back to Matthew chapter 13, where Jesus makes an incredible statement. And this is not a fun statement, but it's an incredible statement. Because here he says he's been using figures of speech or figurative speech so that they could hear him and understand, but the time is coming where I will tell you plainly, he says, without any pretense, without any figurative speech. And I will just directly, plainly tell you about the Father. If the time is coming for that to happen, presumably it's going to happen after he's resurrected. Possibly after he's ascended. And he, as the Holy Spirit, will show them these things. But I couldn't help but go back to Matthew chapter 13 in my own mind as I read this passage. In Matthew chapter 13, if we were to read verses 10 to 17, here's what it says. You know the parable that precedes this, the parable of the sower. And while you know it, while I know it, I have not yet plumbed its depth, because it has more to say about reality as we share the gospel, reality as the gospel was shared with us, than maybe we give it credit for. But we know the parable. Then the disciples came to Jesus and said to him, "Why do you speak to the people in parables?" Maybe we could change it, though we would be wrong to do so. But in our minds, why do you speak figuratively? Why don't you tell them plainly? If you're going to tell us plainly later, why not tell them plainly now? It would make sense. Jesus would have more followers, maybe, if he told them plainly instead of telling them figuratively. And I just want you to understand one thing out of this. We're not looking at all of this passage. We're not going to exegete it. We're not going to break it down. I just want you to understand one thing. And as you read this, as you listen to this, understand that Jesus is bigger than you or me can imagine. He answered them, "To you, it has been given to know the secrets of the kingdom of heaven, but to them it has not been given. For to the one who has, more will be given, and the one who has abundance, or he will have an abundance, but from the one who has not, even what he has will be taken away. This is why I speak to them in parables, because seeing, they do not see, hearing, they do not hear, nor do they understand. Indeed, in their case, the prophecy of Isaiah is fulfilled that says, 'You will indeed hear, but never understand. You will indeed see, but never perceive. For the people's hearts have grown dull, and their eyes and their ears can barely hear, and their eyes have been closed, lest they should see with their eyes and hear with their ears and understand with their heart and turn, and I would heal them. But blessed are your eyes, for they see, and your ears, for they hear. For truly I say to you, my prophets and righteous people longed to see what you see. They do not see it. And to hear what you hear, they did not hear it.'" I do not want to get into the specifics of the theology. That's not the point. But I want you to get that Jesus' purpose, Jesus himself, he's bigger. I don't care how big you think he is. He's bigger. He has a rationale and a purpose and a logic and a plan that will not be thwarted, that will not be ruined, and we cannot possibly get. Because it would make sense to me to speak plainly the whole time so they would hear with their ears and see with their eyes and understand with their minds and turn and repent and be forgiven. But he says, my purpose is not to do that. Because he's bigger, with a bigger plan, with a bigger purpose. He's just simply bigger. That is why he uses figurative speech. But a time is coming, he says, when I will no longer use figurative speech. I will tell you plainly so you can't possibly misunderstand. I will tell you plainly so that is directly stated about the Father. And it is important to understand that it's about the Father because Jesus has taken the Father and placed him perfectly central and prominent to everything else. I must do the same as the preacher on Sunday mornings, but lest you be mistaken, you must do the same. It doesn't give anybody an out in this. If we're to be like Jesus as we see who he is, then as he exalts the Godhead to the central purpose, to the primary place for everything, then so must we. So ask yourself, in this moment, is that what I do? Or do I place centrally good behavior? Do I place centrally working hard? Do I place centrally being nice? Do I place centrally anything else? Or do I place centrally God and the Godhead? Now, mind you, that is a trick question. Because if you tell me you place something else centrally, you know you're wrong. And if you tell me that you place Christ and the Godhead centrally in your life, then you have no excuse to do anything short of chase after him with every molecule of your being. And so you're stuck without a choice. You're stuck without options. You either deny the Jesus that says he's the most important, or you exalt the Jesus who says he's most important, and you let everything else fall away. That doesn't mean you quit your job, but it means your job on this earth is given to you for the one expressed purpose of building his kingdom. Your family on this earth is given to you for the one expressed purpose of radiating the King's glory to the world around us. Every possible thing you will ever get from every moment in the day, from every breath that you take, from every friend that you have and every dollar that you possess is given to you to exalt the King if you believe he's most important. Now see, the disciples understood that he was. They really did. Let's look at it. In that day, he says in verse 26, you will ask him my name, and I do not say to you that I will ask the Father on your behalf. And that's important. That's a shift in what has happened. Nonetheless, I do not say that I will ask the Father on your behalf, for the Father himself loves you, because you have loved me, and you have believed that I came from God. So there is a level of belief. There has to be. I came from the Father and I have come into the world, and now I'm leaving the world and going to the Father. His disciples said, now you are speaking plainly and not using figurative speech. Now We know that you know all things and do not need anyone to question you. This is why we believe you came from God. Let's paraphrase. Oh, you're so smart. You must have come from God. Because you're so smart. Nobody needs to question you. So you must have come from God. Do you now believe? Do you now believe? Really? Are you sure you really believe, he says? Now, I told you, there's really two options on how to take this. Possibly a third, but the third really ends up looking like one of the other ones. So we'll just go with two. Do you now believe? Questioning possibly the validity of the belief. Or do you now believe? Now that I've looked really smart, do you now believe? I think the most of the positions, the most logic that I can come up with falls on the first of the options. Now, I am not going to tell you that that is absolutely right. Why? Because I'm not positive that it is. I've never heard anybody talk about this. Never read any commentaries that break down this question into some four Greek logic formulas and said, here's the only one that makes sense. I've never heard that. So I'm making a guess at it, but I think it makes sense. I think he's saying, do you now believe? Are you sure? All right, disciples, you tell me you're believing. Are you sure that you really believe? And to some level, they do. But friends, their belief has not gone deep enough into who they are. You know how I know? Look at the very next thing Jesus says. Behold, the hour is coming. Indeed, it is here now. When you will be scattered, each to your own home, and you will leave me alone. Do you believe? Are you sure? Friends, he says, are you sure you want to tell me that you believe? Because the hour is coming. Actually, no. It's right here, right now, in moments, when you are going to abandon me. Are you sure that you believe? I know you understand. I know that understanding leads you to some logical conclusions. But do you believe? Really, do you believe? Because if you truly believe, you will not scatter. If you truly believe, you would not leave me alone. If you truly believe, your joy that you've gotten could not be stripped from you. If you really believe, you're going to be different. If you really believe, you're going to ask the Father in my name, and he's going to do amazing things in my name. You're asking on my behalf, as we've talked about before. If you really believe, that's what it will look like. More primal than that, if you really believe, Jesus says you can go to the Father. Up until now, remember how I said that the shift happened here? Up until now, Jesus has gone to the Father for the disciples. He says, now the time is coming when you can go by yourself into the what they would understand as the Holy of Holies, the place where God himself resides. And they can commune with him. They can talk with him. They can have a relationship with him. The time is coming where they can do that. And the question is, do you really believe? There's another component of true belief and how it looks in your life. So if you wonder to yourself, do I really believe? Come back Easter morning and we're going to do something. And we're going to talk about belief. And we're going to talk about what it looks like in life. But in this moment, just let your heart focus on those things. Look at this passage. See what true belief looks like. Ask yourself, when the moment comes, when the options come in life to either run from acting like I know Jesus or boldly run toward acting like I know Jesus to those around me, what do you do? I don't care if you sit on some board of executives somewhere. I don't care if you sit in a classroom full of preschoolers. When the time comes and the opportunities arise to either run to the world proclaiming Jesus or to scatter from Jesus, to leave him alone, what do you do? Understand this, friends. If you choose to run to Jesus and proclaim him to the world, you may well be the one to stand alone. Not figuratively, literally. You may be the only one who chooses that path. On any given moment, on any given day, you may be the only one in your circle who does that. What then when you're alone? You're not. When you stand in that moment and run to Jesus in the midst of this world that wants to ignore him, and you show him to them, you're not alone. Jesus was left alone, right? No. No, he says this. Do you now believe? Behold, the hour is coming. Indeed, it has come when you will be scattered, each to your own home, and you will leave me alone. Yet, I am not alone. You will leave me alone. Yet, friends, I'm not alone. Because there's someone bigger than you who won't ever leave me. There's someone more powerful than you who will never desert me, who will never scatter from me. Fast forward about 30 years, okay? And you come to the Apostle Paul writing to Timothy. 2 Timothy chapter 4 says this. This is Paul writing to Timothy, beginning in verse 14. Alexander the coppersmith did me great harm. The Lord will repay him according to his deeds. Beware of yourself, for he has strongly opposed our message. At my first defense, no one came to stand by me, but all deserted me. Does that not sound a lot like Jesus in John 16? Somebody talked about this out at the conference that we were at, and I couldn't help but think of the passage we're talking about today because the exact same thing happened. And now it's one of us, one of the mere us. But may it not be charged against them, for the Lord stood by me and strengthened me. So now you have Jesus saying, hey, you all are going to scatter and you're going to leave me alone. At least you think you're going to leave me alone, but really, I can't be alone. Really, I cannot be deserted because the one who is the most important will not desert me. Paul, everyone scattered. They all deserted me. I was on trial, he says. And they all deserted me. It's like your lawyer getting up and running from the room. But the Lord was with him. So he's not angry. And he was not alone. The most important one was there. These disciples are going to scatter. And they're going to leave Jesus. And he understood at the core of who he was that he was not alone. He understood that this belief in him and who he was would cause us to not be alone. It would cause us the ability to not scatter if we see him clearly. But friends, if we don't see Jesus clearly, if we have some marred, twisted picture of who he is, if we don't understand that he was the God of the universe, who for no other reason than he chose to love us, came and died in our place so that we don't have to, unless we see that picture clearly, and unless we walk through our life with that picture and that incredible Jesus, first and foremost, plainly seen in our minds, we will surely fail. But when our belief runs so deep, when it seeps so deep into who we are, that every bit of us is consumed with all that we can get of Him, though it's 1/1,000,000th of 1%, then we will be people who strive after Him with reckless abandon, for there's nothing else we want. We will be people who drop everything else aside to gain Him. We will be people who see everything that God has given us, given to us for just one purpose, and that's building His kingdom, and that's knowing Him, and it's exalting Him, and it's all about what? Him. You may get nothing in this world except for what Jesus is going to promise we're going to get in just a moment. And that is trial and tribulation and hardship. He guarantees that for us. You may get nothing other than that. But friends, if you understand you get Jesus, you say, I don't care. Though I lose everything else, I've not lost Him. Because, well, He's the only thing I care about. And when I care about Him rightly, the care for all the people around me who know and don't know Him will be incredible and overwhelming as we look at them and we say, you are an eternal being destined for heaven. Let's get you there as well as we can. Or you're an eternal being right now destined for hell. Let's change that. But if we can look at people and not see those two things, we're not seeing them right. Because we're not seeing Jesus right. And if we really truly get who He is, we will really truly see those people with the value that they have in the reality of who they are. That's the Jesus who stands here in this moment telling His disciples, that they're going to abandon Him, but that they're not the most important. He's going to restore them. He's going to guarantee victory to them. So let's not just wait until next week. Let's look at how it ends. In this world, you will have trouble. You will have hardship. It will break down. It will be awful. Every bad thing you can think of will happen. In fact, He could say, for most of you, you will be killed for who I am. But take heart. He does not say you have overcome the world. He does not say you anything. You will have trial. You will have tribulation. It will break down for you. But don't worry. I already won, He says. I already won. It's like watching a TiVo'd basketball game. The middle, you don't know what's going to happen. But you know the score at the end. Your side wins. Let's pray. God, thank You for Your Son. Thank You for the amazing privilege that we have to be here in this moment to glorify Him. May our hearts, Father, be bent toward making Him known, toward seeing Him right in our own hearts, in our own minds. May we be people, Father, who strive with everything we have to know Your Son. I ask, Father, for us in this moment. I ask for me in this moment. that you not allow us to be people who care as little about you this afternoon as we did this morning. That you not allow us to be people who deprioritize you in our lives. For I know, Father, none of us holds you in the right regard, but I ask that you build that in us. Build that in me. For your glory and your name's sake. Amen.